Hey there, this is the Hello Personality Podcast, the place where you'll learn how to use your personality type to live a radically authentic life that ignites your potential and creates positive ripple effects for all of those around you. I'm Leslie McDaniel, and this is Season 4, Episode 10. And we're wrapping up the interviews with Enneagram head types in this episode as we continue to explore the intersection of the Enneagram and emotional intelligence. Since this is the last head type episode, this means we've arrived at type 7. As a head type, type 7s primarily experience the world through their minds. This means they tend to engage with the world through their thoughts, beliefs, reasoning, mental analysis, and ideas. And all head types have an interesting relationship with the core emotion of fear. The passion for type 7 is gluttony, and the antidote, or virtue, is sobriety. To learn more about the passion and virtues of each type, be sure to check out Season 2, Episode 3. Our guest today is someone I met at an Enneagram retreat, and to be honest, I haven't met a ton of type 7s in my inner work retreats. There tend to be a lot of 9s, 2s, a few 4s, and quite a few 6s. While I have seen all types in this kind of retreat, there tend to be fewer 1s, 3s, 5s, and 7s, at least in my experience. So all that to say, I was really glad to have met Mark, and I was excited when he agreed to do this interview. Mark Barkus is a social 7 on the Enneagram. He has a long history of work in government and nonprofit organizations, but uses the Enneagram wisdom primarily as a framework for his own personal growth and development. As with many of my guests this season, Mark's type is the countertype for sevens. And this means that the social seven goes against gluttony in a particular way. This subtype tends to give more to others and saves less for themselves in an effort to be good or to make sure that they don't exploit others for their own gain. This doesn't mean that the social seven doesn't have issues with the passion of gluttony, because they do, just like the other countertypes and their respective passions. The passion is just more hidden in countertypes, and there tends to be a lot of effort to work against this instinct for countertypes. As you listen to my conversation with Mark, see what you can pick up about the four main aspects of emotional intelligence that we've been talking about this season. They are self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, and social management. As I've mentioned for all of our guests this season, it can be vulnerable to share about deep inner work, so I appreciate Mark's willingness to be here and to share his life and work with us. Whether or not you're a Type 7, you can use this conversation as a mirror to learn about yourself. Notice what comes up in your head, heart, or body. And as per usual, I'll be back at the end of the interview for a few more thoughts. But let's go ahead and dive in with Mark. Hey, Mark, welcome to the Hello Personality Podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. So I'd love to start with a two-part question. And that is, first of all, how did you find the Enneagram and how did you discover your type?
So I've known about the Enneagram since the early 90s. That was back in the days of Iron John and men's groups and things like that. And I was in something around that in the early 90s, and somebody just brought a general discussion of it. And I was intrigued. I'd always sensed that people saw the world in different ways, and it kind of gave a framework for that. At the time, I didn't know very much about it. I decided based on one paragraph per type sheet of paper that I was a 9. Mm. And then I did read Richard Rohr's book and a few other books on the Enneagram at the time. I didn't study it very intensely. I mean, I read about 3 or 4 books, but at the time I was reading lots of different kinds of books. But I always was like, I would explain the Enneagram in general to people. I would explain it as a way to that we all see the world through different lenses. And I said I was a 9. It wasn't until about 6 years ago that I came back to the Enneagram and looked more closely at it and realized that I was not a nine. I'm a social seven. Nines don't like conflict. Sevens don't like pain in front of us and discomfort. And so often those are the same thing, but they're not always the same thing. And it was really once I discovered the subtypes and that I really honed in that I'm a social seven. And that has, in the last 6 years, I've gone pretty deep into the Enneagram really deep into the Enneagram. And so it's kind of the framework for my whole, like, the way I kind of see the world now. I put other things in relation to it and hang things on it, because the more I've explored it, I've still not found the boundaries of finding out new things about myself and new things about others and the world through the Enneagram.
Yeah. So it sounds like you made a pit stop at nine for a little while, or were there any other types that you explored before landing?
Nine seemed to fit best, but the paragraph I read said, you don't like conflict, you like making peace, and you watch too much television to self-medicate. I watched a lot of television. I was trying to be a professional mediator at the time, so I thought that fit just great with what my conception of what I wanted to be was. I was probably a little depressed situationally at the time because of stuff that was going on in my life. And seven sounded too fun. Even back then, I wanted to be a seven, but it didn't sound like it fit me because I wasn't leading the life that maybe a more typical seven led. And because I was always had kind of this sense of focusing on others and sense of duty and those sorts of things that seemed others' needs seemed to govern me a lot, and that. That seemed to fit more with nine, but I never really saw any other type as my type. But when I came to seven, it was like, and especially social seven, I'm like, yep, there I am.
Yeah. I think that's the problem. I think with a lot of the simplistic definitions, you know, you talked about the nines watch a lot of TV, which is not always true. But yeah, so the social seven, you talked a lot about focusing on others and others' needs. And the social seven is the counter type for sevens, right? And can sometimes even mistype as two. So what have you learned about being a social seven and how it shows up differently?
Sure. So like, and the way I describe to people how, in terms of them thinking that we can look like twos, the way I describe it is if you're struggling with your, with a load of groceries, I want to help you because I don't like to see pain in front of me. But if you say you're okay, I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. If a two wants to help you, and if you refuse their help, they get offended. They really want to help you. Mm-hmm. And so it's with them, it's a relationship need. With me, it's just we want the world. I think it was Fergus who said we want social sevens want the world to reflect back to them that the world is a good place. And so we don't like to see pain and discomfort. Some of us, I think, therefore avoid seeing the pain and the discomfort of the world. But others of us kind of dive into trying to alleviate pain and suffering in the world. And so you'll find a lot of us in service professions, as you will find some twos in those professions as well. And that's why we can kind of look alike outside in some of our actions. But my motivations are, you know, if you're okay and you tell me you're okay, I'm probably going to leave you alone. I don't need you to need me.
Yeah.
And whereas a two kind of needs you to need them.
Yeah.
I think.
Absolutely. So the alleviation of pain for sure, being a seven, a key seven feature. And also I hear it's more self-referencing than a two. So it's like filtering through your own needs and your own.
We don't want to see pain because that makes us have pain because we take it on.
Right.
And so to alleviate our pain, we want to eliminate your pain so that we're not seeing it. I don't know whether it's conscious or not. I've always been drawn. I've had a career in public service, and I've had kind of a volunteer career in nonprofit world, oriented towards making the world, making the situation better for people. I think a lot of that comes from kind of that need to, I do have an awareness of the pain in the world, and I feel a responsibility that is probably coming out of my social seven to do what I can. But it's not relational. It's just, I feel better. I think I probably feel better being in the world if I know that I'm at least doing what I can. As I've grown and as I think I've become more healthy, I've also appreciated kind of the sacred emotions, the sacred side of them, and that there is a sacred sadness in accepting that there is sadness in the world and accepting those. A lot of sevens have avoid sadness. I feel I've been pretty in touch with sadness. That may be just the situation that I've placed myself in and the way I was raised. I do understand that that exists in the world, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I think this is common of a lot of sevens, especially social sevens. We want to cheer you up. We don't know those types that are comfortable with just staying in melancholy and all that. We don't understand that. We don't understand why anyone wants to feel that. And so we want to help you pull out of it. I have the image of kind of like a pearl diver. Like, I'll go down and get that sad emotion, but I don't want to stay down there. I'd like to come up. I'll go feel it. I don't need to linger there. And so the work is sitting with it, at least through the 90 seconds that it takes an emotion to really go through your body. Yeah. So some of the work that I do is trying to, if I am feeling that kind of negative emotion, to feel it through, knowing intellectually that it will pass or it will go through, but not just avoid it.
Yeah. And so feeling it in your body, it sounds like, and that's something I've talked about with other guests as well. It sounds like it's an important piece for you. How aware are you of that emotion in your body? Does it, like, do you have to be sensed?
So that's been my work.
Yeah.
You know, that's the last, especially the last 6 months to a year, is to kind of really sense that in my body and to identify where, and that goes for all the emotions, but where I'm feeling it. Because I think even though, you know, they say that sevens are, you know, head types and maybe repressed in heart or feeling, it's really, I haven't felt repressed in feeling so much as unaware or cut off from my body unless I'm conscious about it. So it does have to be a conscious move to noticing how things are in my body. Mm-hmm. And so that's, for me right now, it's conscious work. I don't do it unconsciously. Yeah. And sometimes I have to catch myself if I have a headache or if I have something to kind of like analyze that. Well, is this a physical or an emotional source, or what is there something causing this physical feeling, a queasiness or an energy? And that's true of positive emotions as well, trying to feel positive emotions in the body. My goal is to become more body aware. I think that's healthy for anyone, but it's something that I need to do. I do a lot of, I'm not great at a practice of breathing other than remembering to, like, okay, several times a day, okay, let's take some deep breaths.
Yeah.
And it's not regimented, but it is sort of like several times a day, I will go, let's take some deep breaths. And I will catch myself having not breathed and then be doing a deep breath. And so, oops, I wasn't breathing. And I need to be more aware of that.
Yeah. So you mentioned you didn't think it was necessarily being unaware or cut off from your emotions. Did I hear that correctly? Like,
yeah. And they say that sevens only have that half range of emotions. I think we like to stay in the half range of emotions, but I think we have the other emotions. Mm-hmm. I've actually said that the sense of duty, I think, is the barrier emotion in the middle that protects. It doesn't just protect us from the negative emotions. It protects the world from our negative emotions. Because I think when we're not as, and this is, nothing is ever universal. So I don't speak for all sevens or all social sevens or even my sequence, but I think we are not as adept at dealing with the negative emotions. And maybe we do those in a more primitive, or we can do those in a more primitive or less sophisticated way, whereas Forrest may be comfortable and maybe more, they may do that better, may do that more thoroughly. We can process other positive emotions, I think, better than many types, and find, for example, joy in things that others may not be able to find joy in.
Yeah.
But with regard to negative, we are kind of a tourist there, and so we are not necessarily comfortable there. We're observing, and so for us to actually then bring it in and actually feel it is usually a conscious act, I think, or a conscious act to be. It's either we feel it and don't understand it, so it's defining it, or we see it and don't feel it, and so we have to consciously see, like, well, where is that?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's this, belief and understanding that type sevens can reframe pretty much anything.
Yep.
And is that, you find that true then for your life as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, but I think we do it both negative. I think when it's unconscious, it's a problem and negative because that is making us avoid things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a talent that we have that when we do it consciously is a superpower and can not just help ourselves, but help others. There's not just two sides to the way I see the world. There's not just two sides. I'm also into non-duality, but there's not just two sides. There's multiple sides, multiple ways of looking at things. And you can tell me a problem and I can spin it, and it may be a joke, but I can spin it how this could be not a problem. This could be an opportunity. This could be a good thing or whatever. Of course, there's some things that are really, you don't do that flippantly. Things like death and those things are, and tragedy and suffering and those kinds of things. When you get to the sacred level of the emotions, there's a philosophical non-dualist outlook for that. That's not a jokey reframing, but that is kind of a understanding that you don't have happiness without sadness. You don't have light without dark, and that they have, there is that in the world, and there will be that in the world, and there is no perfect. I don't believe in a perfect, but I do believe in a whole.
Yeah. I was laughing a little bit because at the beginning I felt like you did reframe.
Yeah.
You said that it's a superpower. You reframed the reframing and made it a superpower.
I can reframe in multiple ways, and yeah. What I try to do is I try to be conscious about it, and I try not to. I think when I was younger, I can see, we're also future focused. So for me, I have to like think what I was like before, but I think I could use reframing. I called it optimism, seeing it optimistically, but as a way to avoid distress or negativity. That's someone I respected did something disrespectful, and I found a way to and it might have been disrespectful to me, but I found a way to not react to it in that way. For most people, you are to me the best thing you ever did. Mm-hmm. And so I'll hold to that. So when I'm in a position in life or in work or wherever where I need to hold people to their responsibilities or stand up for myself or say what my needs are or my view is, or I'm pretty good about saying what my view is, but I don't like conflict particularly because that's discomfort. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much that I don't like seeing discomfort. So even if it's not about me, if I have to say something to someone else that I know will make them uncomfortable or negative, that creates a discomfort for me that I'm going to see them. So I have to be careful to not mask that by not seeing it, by just like sending the message but not seeing them in person or that kind of thing. And so it is real work for me to be one-on-one. I'm also, of my instincts, I'm sexual repressed. So one-on-one is very much an effort for me. Whereas I can talk to a group much more easily than I can talk to one person. Mm-hmm. I'm great once I'm in a relationship or in a conversation. It's hard for me to initiate it with a stranger. So that is almost always an effort. Most of my friends do not understand that because they're already in relationship with me. So they don't see that I struggle with that, but it has to be a conscious effort for me.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I want to go back to some of the things we've been touching on and the avoidance of pain or avoidance of negativity. And, if you could like share, like, what is that about? Do you believe in your life?
Well, I think sevens honestly don't know why you would not want to avoid pain. We really don't understand that. We don't understand why you would not want to avoid negative emotion. Mm-hmm. I was still telling my therapist, everyone should get a therapist. I was telling my therapist the other day, I've been much better about feeling negative emotion in my body. I don't understand why you people want to do this. It's very unpleasant.
Because it's part of the human experience, perhaps?
Yeah, because it's part of the human experience. But, you know, it's like, okay, well, that's okay. Now I've done it. I will continue to do it, but I don't really understand what the big deal about it is, why you all are all fans of it. Mm-hmm. And so you know, with sevens, we are looking for joy. And I think the other emotions get in. It's not just that they are negative in their own. They get in the way of that pursuit. Mm-hmm. We so want joy. They say with sevens, we want joy, we'll settle for happiness. Mm-hmm. It's a real drive that we want joyousness, and not just for ourselves. We want to, social sevens especially, want to see joyousness. When I'm attracted to a variety of things that where it is, I see it as joyful. I'm attracted to spectacle and costumes and pageantry and all of that kind of stuff. I'm attracted to anything where even if I'm not interested in what the subject matter is, the people there are very enthusiastic about it. That makes me happy. To go to a movie with its intended audience is, I don't even care what the movie is. If the audience around me is really responding to it, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. And so this is reminding me of the Passion of Sevens as gluttony. And it sounds a bit about that pursuit of pleasure in a way. Would you equate joy and the pursuit of pleasure, or is it different?
Sure. I think joy is the pure form of that. And I think there's nothing wrong with joy. I think because joy is kind of a rarefied thing that you to get to, we're looking for it. So in the course of that, we are wanting options. We are wanting experience. Personally, I'm not like gluttony for me comes with experience. Gluttony for experience. I want to do everything. Fear of missing out is profound in me, or has been. I'm better about that, but that's my work, is to be better about that and to work on that. I have things scheduled and busy things that I have to do and some pre-planned travel or whatever, but I'm trying to not plan until the end of September, not make other plans for Enneagram conferences or travel or those kinds of things that are generated by me. We love planning. And so, you know, if I'm going, okay, my wife and I just got back from Italy. We did the Dante workshop with Beatrice Chestnut, which was fantastic. And Dante and the Enneagram and Florence. But I knew I was doing that for 6 months. And so I curtailed myself a little bit. And of course, you're planning a trip, so you're going to research some things. In the past, I would have been obsessed with that. I would have been obsessed with, you know, what I can pack into the 2 weeks that I'm in Italy, all of that kind of stuff. We still did stuff, my wife and I, but we did a lot less than I probably would have done 10 years ago had I gone on a similar trip, because I don't know what I'm going to like, and I don't know what's going to bring joy. And so the more experiences I can generate, the more likelihood I'm going to have that. the one thing that was interesting for me in the work, and this was kind of just an early low hanging fruit thing about sevens, is to, and recognizing that we are planning for the future, even when we're in the present. Mm-hmm. We're at the concert that we wanted to go to, but we're thinking about the next concert or dinner, mm-hmm. or whatever, instead of just being in that moment. So an early task I set myself was to really savor moments and to be but that's a conscious thing. And to also, what I gave myself was, I'll give you a couple of things that you can look forward to at all times. You'll always have something you can look forward to, but you also need to savor the moment that you look forward to. But, and then I've tried to move that to savor whatever moment you're in and be present in the moment you're in, and find the joy. Seven, that's good at finding joy. Find the joy in whatever, even in things like sadness and loss, because even I lost both my parents in the last couple of years, and it was not because of the pandemic, but it was during the pandemic, which put all sorts of things that broke out of what the traditional way that we would handle those kinds of things. Yeah. But it was very sad, and I was feeling that sadness and I was being conscious of that, but I was also being conscious of the joy of their lives and the connections that we were able to make with each other during it, and the lessons I was learning about life and all of that during it. And that was from being consciously present. And I think I think that's hard for everyone to really do it.
Absolutely.
I think the sevens, there is a real challenge for sevens because we are so future focused.
Yeah, absolutely. So we were talking about planning, and it sounds like the obsessive planning, I don't know if you'd call it obsessive, but it's to try to pack in as many as experiences as possible.
Oh, it's a hobby.
Okay. Yeah. Just, I
but
guess
like my calendar, I mean, your listeners can't see it, but I've got like all sorts of, like, I like to have a full calendar. Yeah. I like to be able to.
For what purpose?
It gives me, it makes me know that I'm going to be doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings pleasure or activity. And mm-hmm. pleasure, it doesn't even have to be pleasurable activity to know that I'm going to be busy, that I'm going to be engaged, that I'm going to be with people. Mm-hmm. Strangely, during the pandemic, when no one could do anything and all sorts of things were canceled, I didn't have as much fear of missing out mm-hmm. as I thought I probably sevens might have.
Yeah.
Because there were no concerts, there were no trips and things like that. And so that gave time for reflection. And of course, you know, there was other planning that you do and that kind of stuff. But it was interesting because it's really hearing how, you know, it is typical for me to hear about something, maybe on Instagram or somebody says something, and to immediately go to my calendar and see where it is, when it is there a way I could go do it? Is there a way I could participate?
Yeah.
And it can be something I had never thought of until that moment, but let me go see if that's a possibility in my life, because it seemed cool when I heard it. Yeah. And that could just be an Instagram about a interesting place that people have visited or something like that. I'm like, oh, well, let me go look.
Yeah. Do you always,
and it's almost an immediate reaction.
Yeah. Do you always follow through on your plans, or is it more about just the idea of having those options?
I always follow through if I've already bought the tickets.
Okay.
But until I've taken action of some sort, it's often there are big parts of my life where I made lots and lots of plans that just never, I don't even think I really thought they would ever come to fruition. And if I make really long-term plans, I used to, and I think a lot of people do this in terms of just their fantasy of their future. Like, you know, I would think about like, okay, you know, what kind of house do I want to live in? What kind of, you know, what all do I want? What kind of, you know, I've planned to start companies that I never started. Mm-hmm. I have ideas for I'm not in the restaurant business. I've had lots of like detailed plans for what a restaurant would be like, you know, that I think is a good idea. I have no ability to execute on that, and I don't do that anymore, but there are all sorts of businesses like that, that I have no expertise in. I'm not an entrepreneur, but the thinking of it, I love it. Actually, I actually do love it when I can, and I think this is a strength of Sevens for others, is when they want to run ideas by us. We're really great at running with ideas mm-hmm. and having lots of ideas about your idea and how to expand it and how to do that. But do not assign us the execution of it, because unless we're going to one and getting it done, do not rely on us.
Yeah, I love it. You're talking there about a couple of things about the seven, the optimism of like, just possibilities, endless possibilities galore, and the constant ideating in your mind. I think that's a pretty key seven characteristic. And I hear it even in your speech, you know, there's lots and lots of ideas going through your mind, it sounds like, at any one time.
At any one time, dozens of things. I'm trying to be present, and I'm trying to focus on our conversation today, but there are three or four other things going on in my mind at any given time, if not more.
Yeah. So you've done some work, it sounds like, and we talked a bit about being present. Like, how do you combat that? Or how do you combat is not the right word probably, but how do you manage that?
Yeah, I don't think it's something you fight against. I think it's something you fight for and you move towards and you move into consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that in terms of being present, that because I didn't understand why the people, two, six, and one who are oriented to the now, not to the future or past, why they weren't more present. But then I determined that when they say the present, that's different from being present. Mm-hmm. So I call it the immediate. There's the immediate, there's the past, and there's the future.
Right.
So to be present, you really have to balance those. And for me, it is consciousness. It is sometimes it's meditation. Sometimes it's doing things just to calm down and to be present, and to see the value of it, because I have seen the value of it. I think because of some exercises I was doing, I was able to be present in Florence in a way that I haven't been on vacation before. And I really got a rich experience out of Florence itself and being there. I went through a couple of weeks where I was, without even knowing it, being present in one-on-one conversations with people. I had a friend, I went to El Paso for some other event, but I have a friend from college there that had a stroke about 8 years, my age, college friend, had a stroke about 8 years ago. I had not seen him since college. He had had a big, powerful life. He had been a regional sales manager. He had a big social life. And then on a dime, he had a severe stroke and his life completely changed. Now he lives in the house he grew up in, has very limited contact with folks, just neighbors and his sister. And I think out of a sense of duty, I felt, well, I'm in town. I haven't seen him in person. I should go by and see him. So I did that, but I was really present with him, and it's very different to see someone in person than communicating with them online, especially if they have something like a stroke. And I found that I stayed 4.5 hours and wasn't even aware of how long I was staying. Mm. And that was a gift that presence gave me. I was not conscious at that point. I was not trying to be consciously present, but I had been practicing conscious presence. And that's my goal, is that by doing things as conscious practices, you get more where you're more just receptive to that experience just when you encounter things in the world. Mm-hmm. And for me, that it's been significant for me as I've worked on my repressed one-on-one instinct. Trying to be present has really helped me bring that up more than anything else, I think, at this point.
Yeah. So We've touched on some of your emotions and fear in particular, and I want to talk a little bit more about that, since that is all the head types have a particular relationship with fear. And right. So what is your relationship with fear?
Well, the seven relationship with fear is to ignore it. And so
I'm sensing a theme.
Yes. So we ignore fear and I think deny it. And it actually comes as a surprise when people tell us that sevens are in the fear triad, because we're like, we are. I mean,
right.
We don't understand that. We actually think like, well, we're heart types, you know, but we're not, but we don't have shame. So it's, or I'm sorry, I don't experience shame as I've heard it defined in terms of lack of worthiness. But fear is very elusive for me. And what I've discovered lately is that fear is behind a lot of, because I will feel anxiety. And as I've done more work, and I'm also like learning about, there's a group and a book, Conscious Leadership, that talks about the underlying emotions behind some of the things that we're experiencing. That's been helpful. And I think under my anxiety is a fear, either a fear of being unhappy, a fear of letting people down, a fear of letting myself down, a fear of not living life to the fullest. I think these are all fears that are masked by anxiety or generalized stress, a feeling of stress. Unless I'm in a physically dangerous situation, I've not had a physically dangerous life particularly. I wouldn't say I'm fearless. I don't do extreme sports or anything like that, but I'm a little fear. I'm not really afraid of things as people would describe them, but underlying my anxiety, I think, are these other fears that I do have, and they relate to, I mean, certainly I think there's a real fear of not living a full life.
Yeah.
And I think that is probably the most seven fear I have, is that.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you sense that anxiety, is that a signal for you, as you were talking about with your body, to unravel that and see what's underneath that fear?
Right. And that's the work I've been trying to do the last 6 to 12 months, is to do that. And is to, when I encounter anxiety, don't just see it as anxiety, go deeper as to what's underneath the anxiety. Is it fear? Is it anger? I have a real hard time. And I never know whether or not I'm just like done a lot of work, and so I'm just not as angry anymore because I'm old. Or whether or not I'm ignoring anger, because I've really, really been looking for it. And I can feel upset in the moment. I can feel annoyance, those low level angers. Mm-hmm. But I just convert that really quickly into, anger just dissipates so quickly for me. I have others in my family that feel it much more profoundly and visibly and all of that. I'm visibly angry so infrequently that when I am, it scares people, because it's just not part of my demeanor. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's fear and sometimes it's anger, sometimes it's sadness, but there's mostly, I'm finding that it's fear when I go underneath anxiety, even things like annoyance, I'm usually annoyed because I'm either worried that I'm not, it's about a responsibility that I'm now going to have, that I'm fearful that I won't handle. If I don't handle it, something will happen, or it's a responsibility. I worry that I caused, I caused the situation. Mm-hmm. We're very vain. We think we caused everything too. Mm-hmm. So I, So I think that's a fear of causing pain. I have a fear of causing pain.
Yeah.
And I'm sure underneath that fear is a not wanting to feel pain. Because there's always layers under layers, you know.
Yeah. I think also, and you can correct me if this is wrong, but it sounds a little bit too like the social seven desire to be good and to be pure. You said you've talked a few times about not wanting to cause issues or cause pain, and you feel responsible for things. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, for my whole life, I've been complimented for being the good this, the good that, a good guy, a good person, a good this, a good that, a good father. And I think, I mean, I think I am good. I mean, I think I'm a good person. I think I'm a good, all of those things. But at the same time, we see our own inadequacies. And so we are, you know, we can have, I don't really have imposter syndrome right now because I've gotten in touch with humility, I think, is seeing not just your weaknesses, but your strengths and being just realistic about where you are and what you are. I think I'm in touch with that and I kind of am realistic about those things, but I'm very uncomfortable when someone's complimenting me and I don't agree with them about a specific thing. Cause you will get that in life. People will compliment you and it's not necessarily an empty compliment from them, but you know more of the situation and you're like, I really would prefer you not talk to me, not say that about me. Cause that's, I don't want to see that. Also, there's just a part of me that, I had a friend once that she was jokingly, but she said, you know, everyone says you're so nice. Everyone's saying Mark is nice. You're not nice. And I took that as just as being seen. Like, there's more to us than that. But I think we adapt to that image that others have of us and we feel in the especially social sevens. And we feel, I think sometimes a duty to uphold that and to, it's almost like we don't want to burst other people's bubble about the fact that we have wicked sides. You know, I can have a wicked sense of humor and I enjoy satire and I enjoy all of that. And that can sometimes, I'm trying to not lean into that when it's destructive to others as much as maybe I did. I was more sarcastic probably when I was younger and before I did more of the work. And I am not pure at all at this point. I'm sure I still do that at times. But I think it's like once we have that reputation, we feel we have to live up to it. When I'm in a social setting where people don't know me and I can just be whatever, it's kind of an interesting, I almost play a new role just to try things out.
Yeah.
Especially if it's something they're not going to know me, like a meeting, I'm in something, it's just for that group. That group will never be together again. I can just kind of play out a personality, see how it works.
Yeah. It's like an optimism again, or possibilities, or kind of like, let's just see what happens here.
Sure. Yeah. I have a theater degree and like we went to Comic-Con a few years ago and I did a character and I chose a devil, a Crawley from Good Omens and got to just embody that all day. And nice. I just love that because it was very purposefully not good.
Yeah.
Purposefully. I mean, we can argue about Crawley because he has a heart too, but unfortunately for him, but it was like, I really kind of enjoyed kind of the being the opposite of what people perceive me as, and embodying that.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, I did want to talk a little bit about your relationship to other people's emotions. I know we've talked about you not wanting them to feel pain, but what is your capacity for sitting with other people in their emotions, whether it is sadness or anger or happiness even?
It has to be conscious usually for me to sit with it and to not try to change it. And we also don't understand why everyone doesn't have the instinct to try to make things better for anyone. for me, if someone is angry, I want to calm them down. If someone is fearful, I want to reassure them. If someone is sad, I want to cheer them up. And when I intellectually, and I often do that, I often do all of those things through humor. Mm-hmm. And you know, the universe has taught me I'm good at that. And I think it teaches sevens that we're good at that. So it has to be a very conscious effort on my part to just sit with someone else's emotion. And I cannot do it for a long, I mean, I am very conscious of how long I'm doing it. Yeah. I'm very conscious of how long I'm doing it. So it seems like time drags when I'm in someone else's negative emotion for me to resist trying to pull them out of that negative emotion and bring them closer to happiness or calm or whatever.
Yeah. So I guess it would probably be different then for happiness, as you mentioned earlier, like even being around a bunch of people who are enthusiastic or happy. Like, it sounds like that's probably feeds you.
I'm good with that. And yeah. I will probably try to gin it up even more. I'll probably when people are in good moods, I go into it and I reinforce that and get them into even better moods. I love when someone is making a joke and we keep joking and we build on it and we do that kind of stuff. I was just spent the weekend with my daughter in North Carolina and we had that kind of relationship, and she was saying something and I was responding in a way that was encouraging her to go further into the kind of fun of, it was just a funny concept that she had, but I was encouraging her more and she got into it. And that kind of, yes, anding people in from the improv world, but like just kind of going with that. I'm also extroverted, so I do derive energy from being with people. And so that's kind of addictive. I mean, not addictive, and energizing to me to be around that, to be around other people's happiness.
Yeah, that sounds like.
I can't ever remember resenting other people's happiness, except if they were happy at the expense of someone. But generally, if someone's happy about anything, I'm happy they're happy.
Yeah, you're right there with them.
Yeah,
and take cranking it up to 10, maybe.
Sure. And if I, you know, and it's like if I don't know anything about the subject that they're happy about, it will, you know, I'll still try to connect to it.
Yeah.
Just on the happiness level.
Yeah, love that. So, Mark, I really appreciate you sharing with us from your life and about your emotions. Is there anything that you feel like you didn't get to say or about your life experience? Anything, final words you want to share about sevens?
No, I think in terms of the Enneagram, I think it's a wonderful dynamic system that has been a lot for me to deeply explore on a personal level. I say that for people to invite people in. It's been a lot of, you know, I think I'm cheerful and all that today. It really does make you do hard work if you really work the work. And so I'm not really into the like surface discussions about Enneagram, other than to just kind of explain what it's done for me and invite people into it if they want further discussions. So, with sevens, you know, I guess the message most sevens give is like, we may seem cheerful and all that, and sometimes people may not think we're serious people. Mm-hmm. We're pretty deep thinkers.
Yeah.
We just are good at giving you what we think you need, which is happiness. And so we can tend to not share, at least social sevens, not share what we would like. So if you have a seven in your life that you want to do things for, we'd love to have things done for us, but we have a very hard time articulating what that is. And, so we would love to be taken care of. But we won't usually ask for that.
Yeah. My understanding too is sevens, it really bothers sevens to be seen as surface or to be seen kind of without depth. Is that true for you?
Yeah. I think that may be why I kind of orient myself into real work. And I mean, real, but what I mean is like real, like visibly doing good in the world, public service, that sort of work, is because, you know, I often think, well, I'd rather be in a creative field. I'd rather be doing that kind of stuff that seems to fit my personality better. And yet I've done, you know, 40 years of not that. And, and that may have been just my reaction to not being wanting to be seen as a lightweight or frivolous or that, or weak. Maybe I didn't want to be seen as weak. Maybe we see lack of seriousness as weak. Mm-hmm. But as you grow and as you develop, I think sevens also, if they're healthy, they start to see that, like, okay, well, they don't have to take me seriously. I take myself seriously. And I'll find that inner validation, and that will be sufficient. But I think when we're not doing the work, or when we're in unhealth, we can resent others being taken more seriously just because they're sad, or just because they're serious or dour or that. We don't do ourselves any service in that area by joking all the time, but it's almost uncontrollable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for leaving us with those final words of paying attention to what's really going on with sevens, and maybe having a new way of seeing our sevens in our lives. So Great. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Take care.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mark, for being a guest and wrapping up the head types for us. And thank you for helping us to understand a little more about what it's like to be a type 7, and particularly a social 7. In my conversation with Mark, we touched on several aspects of the type 7, including his optimism, his ability to reframe just about anything, and his desire to not only avoid his own pain, but also to alleviate other people's pain as a social 7. As Mark has done some inner work, his desire has become to be more present with the immediate, instead of being so future-focused with his ideas and plans, as he talked about, and to consciously work to be with his own emotions and others, especially the so-called negative emotions of anger, fear, and sadness. So what did you learn while listening? Did you pick up any of the aspects of the social 7 that I mentioned in the introduction? What inspired you from what Mark shared? I'll leave you with those questions to contemplate as we wrap up here. But coming up next, we have one final guest this season. I'll welcome Scott Allender, the author of The Enneagram of Emotional Intelligence, to the show to talk about some important aspects of growing your emotional intelligence. I'll see you then. Take care.